History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. Our program today is evidence that they don't have to go untold and that sometimes those hometowns really are very, very small. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're always entertained, and so often we end up drawing inspiration from these memories from our men and women in uniform. Many of you have asked me over the years how you can actually meet in person some of the hometown heroes that we get to know on the radio. And for those of you out west, there's an opportunity to do just that on Tuesday, November 4th. It's a special fundraising dinner that quite a few veterans will attend, and the program includes my having the privilege of conducting some brief interviews with two World War II veterans you've gotten to know through this show, and also a decorated Vietnam fighter pilot who I have the privilege of introducing you to today. Doors will open at 5 p.m. in Reedley, California on November 4th. I have all the information for you at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you're also going to find a link to the documentary, The Mystery Experiment, which features, among other veterans, today's guest, 85-year-old Chuck Shaheen of Fresno, California, originally from a nearby hamlet called Orange Cove. If Chuck were to suit up for an Air Force ball today, he could display the Silver Star, the Distinguished Flying Cross, which he was awarded four times, and the Purple Heart, among other decorations. But the way he ended up with such an accomplished career in aviation goes back to a conversation in the late 1950s at Reedley High School.
When I was in high school, one day a kid said, I'm not going to be at school tomorrow. I said, how come? He said, well, I'm going to go up to Castle Air Force Base. I said, what are you going to do up there? He says, I'm going to take the West Point exam. I said, West Point exam? Why would you want to do that? He says, it's a free education. It's a fantastic education. I said, how do you know that? He said, my uncle went to West Point. I said, so you get out of school to do that? And he said, yeah. I said, can I go up and take the test too? Yeah. Well, I ended up with a nomination. He didn't. He had a physical problem. And I was the first alternate, so the next year I had gone to Reedley College, so I decided, you know, I was going to go spend another 4 years at West Point. And I didn't have that much desire to do so anyway. So I attended Reedley College, and one night we were out carousing and messing about, and a kid that I was with said, I got to head home early. I'm on a fly tomorrow. I said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to fly. I said, well, what's your destination? He said, I'm going to fly. Don't you know we have a flying club? I belong to the flying club. I said, you're kidding. He said, no. He said, go out with me tomorrow. So I said, oh, okay. So I go out, and the instructor at Great Western said, Rick, the airplane's down. He said, but come back Thursday. And he asked who I was, and Rick introduced us, and he said, would you like to fly for the club or with the club? And I said, I don't know. He said, come out Thursday, and I'll give you a ride. I'd been in an airplane a couple of times as a kid, so I went out and got a ride, and I decided that, you know, I really liked it. So the rest of the year, I spent all my money for flying lessons. During that year, another buddy of mine said, hey, you really need to settle down and get with academia. I said, I'm carrying a lot of units. What's wrong with that? No, you need to get to a good school and actually buckle down. I said, what'd you have in mind? He says, I'm going to go to the University of Oregon. I said, why do you want to go up there? He said, they had a fantastic architectural school program. I said, but I don't want to be an architect. He said, yeah, but we could go up there and we can get an apartment, live off campus, and be on our own. Well, that kind of appealed to me, and I'd always been somewhat enchanted with adventure. Let me digress. When I was a kid, my father's cousin was a merchant marine. He would come and tell us about all of his travels and into foreign countries, and I was always enchanted by that. I always thought I'd like to really travel and see places. So it was a new experience for me to go up to the University of Oregon and get away from home. So I went along, and I applied and got accepted and went to the University of Oregon. Well, that was a land-grant college, so you had to take ROTC. I completed my private license while I was up there. I was playing in the ROTC band of Air Force, and one day the band commander came up to me and he said, somebody told me you fly. And I said, yeah. He said, how would you like to fly for the Air Force? I said, well, what do I have to do? He said, well, you have to take the AFOQT. And I told him I'd already passed the West Point exam. And he said, no, we have our own. And I said, but I'm a sophomore taking freshman ROTC. And he said, well, you could double up next year. I said, well, when do I have to take the test? And he says, Saturday. So I thought, well, you know, what have I got to lose? So I took the test, and I scored high enough to get a flying slot. That determined my career from then on in. I basically took all the courses I needed to graduate. I ended up in an education so I could get out 4 years or 3 years remaining. So when I graduated, I got my commission into the Air Force, and I had a flying slot. I returned back to the Valley, worked in the packing house for the summer, and in September departed for Lubbock, Texas. And Lubbock was much like Fresno, a farm town pretty much. And so I went through pilot training at Reese Air Force Base. It was a one-year program. We were the first class at Reese, but not in the Air Force, but the first class at Reese to fly the T-37 and the T-38, which was a new supersonic trainer. So that's how I got started into flying, and that's where I ended up.
A lot of pilots that I've talked to over the years, they have some kind of moment where there was this aviation bug that grabbed a hold of them. Before, you know, your buddy in high school or your buddy in junior college said, I'm going flying. Had you ever even entertained that idea?
I remember playing as a kid, and we saw bombers going overhead. And a kid that I was playing with said, that's what I want to do, fly. And I thought, what a nut, you know. What's your chances of flying? Now, you have to remember, I was raised in Orange Cove area. We were short on aspiration and long on labor. You know, it was not exactly the conducive place to expand your horizons. So it was kind of like, I really didn't entertain it because there was nothing in my scope that said, you know, you could do that. As I got more and more exposed to the outer world, and my horizons expanded. So to me, it was another adventure. It was a great adventure, and I loved to fly.
And was there a point in your flying career where either you had to decide or the Air Force decided for you what kind of planes you were going to fly?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I graduated high enough to get a choice. They came down with F-100s, F-4s. There was a 101, I think, maybe a couple of those. Then a lot of B-52s and transport. So a buddy of mine said, what are you going to choose? And I said, well, I'm going to choose a 135. And he said, why would you want to do that? I said, because I want to go overseas. He said, you can go overseas in a fighter. I said, you can? He said, yeah, there's plenty of bases overseas. I said, well, let's take an F-4. He said, nah, we'll end up in the back seat. He said, let's take the F-100. I said, you're kidding. He said, that's an old airplane. He said, yeah, but it's a single seat and a single engine. We'll be flying right out of the get-go. So I thought about it, and I said, okay, as long as we can, you know, get overseas. So then we went to fighter school. Well, first we went to survival up at Stead Air Force Base for, I think it was 3 weeks. And then we got an assignment to Luke Air Force Base, where there was a big training base for the F-100. Sure enough, fortunately, I graduated high enough there to get a overseas base, and so did the fellow buddy of mine that had enlightened me. He ended up, by the way, he ended up a two-star general. And fact is, it was really remarkable. In my class, I think there are two of the guys that I was with in the service for 5 years together, the same base, same squadron. One made 4 stars and one made 2. And I think there was another classmate we had, although he went in a different direction. He made a brigadier. So anyway, we got an assignment to RAF Lakenheath in England. Another great experience in that we arrived in England, and we were not able to get off base because we had to pass bomb school. And they wanted us to get OR operationally ready as soon as possible so we could help pull alert and do all the things we needed to do. So for the first 2 or 3 weeks, we were really basically studying and flying, and we didn't have time to even get off base. But when we did, we went, we were very near Cambridge, and So for our first time we got off base, it was really an experience because, you know, in those days, going to England, it was like stepping back about 40 or 50 years. They were a little bit behind us. They didn't have all the amenities that we had. You couldn't get gas on Wednesday afternoons because they shut down for market. They didn't have an ability to go to a grocery store and one-stop shop. You had to go to the greengrocer for your vegetables. You had to go to the meat market for your meat. You had to go to the bakery for your bread. You had to go to the grocery store for your canned goods. Things were not open during the weekend. There were no gas stations open, or at least in the countryside. So it really was quaint, and it was just a real overwhelming experience to see what other people lived like. And so it was a great awakening, and I realized from then on how very fortunate we were in the United States. And no matter where I went, I never found a place that I wanted to live any more than I did in our country. We were so far ahead in so many ways. But I enjoyed England. I enjoyed the base. I enjoyed going to London. While I was there, we had to do a fair amount of being on alert. We had 12 airplanes on alert 24 hours a day, not 360 days a year.
For those who are looking for context here, I mean, this is really the height of the Cold War, right? There's tension with the USSR.
We had a dual mission. We had a nuclear mission, and we also had conventional weaponry. And so we would pull alert, we would fly, we'd fly low levels just like we were going to war. 2 weeks out every month, we went down to North Africa where we had a very large range. We had a range that was 10 miles by 10 miles out in the desert. And we do all of our gunnery, or most of our gunnery and our bomb dropping and our strafing and our air-to-air work down in North Africa because the weather was so much nicer. It was sunny almost every day, except when the wind started blowing and we got what they called a ghibli, which was a sandstorm. So it very seldom rained, and so it was ideal for all of the units in Europe at that time would go down to North Africa. And when I say all the units, there was probably, let's see, three, four, five, six or seven wings that would send their people down for qualification. There were one, two, three, four bases in Germany. These are just fighters. Mm-hmm. And there was one, two, three, four, five in England as well. Wow. So we'd go down two weeks every quarter, which, you know, that's 2 months a year. Then we had other commitments. We would go to pull alert in Turkey, or we'd pull alert in Italy. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty busy. We didn't have a lot of time to horse around or boondoggle. Earlier on, there were some of the schools that you really wanted to attend, like ski school and in Scandinavia, but those all went by the wayside when we got up there.
And just hearing you mention the Ghiblis in North Africa, did you ever get caught flying in one of those?
No, for the most part, you got early warning on them. And really, they had to bat down the hatch, so to speak, because they were very abrasive. And there were times when you couldn't see, 50 yards in front of you or 20 yards in front of you. Yeah. And same way in England. The weather in England always seemed dank, you know. So that's why we did have gunnery ranges in France and in England. But, we didn't have the ideal weather conditions most of the time. And when I was there, I think England was, and most of Europe, was pretty weather challenged. I've been back to Europe several times since, and I don't think they have the weather that they used to have. I think it's changed a good bit. But in those days, we would be flying in all types of weather. We flew on every one of our missions. We flew in two ships or four ships. The weather could go down in Europe to the point where it was 0-0, and in many cases we had some people hung out and barely made it into land.
And for the uninitiated, tell them what 0-0 means.
Well, a zero visibility. And, the height of the clouds was zero. It's on the ground, and the forward distance that you could see was zero.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 85-year-old Chuck Shaheen of Fresno, California. I think we need to hear how he felt about those nuclear missions during the Cold War, and we definitely need to hear about the day he earned the Silver Star Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for details about that Honor Flight fundraiser on November 4th in Reedley, California that Chuck's going to be a part of. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with decorated fighter pilot Chuck Shaheen of Fresno, California, originally from Orange Cove, which at the time was so small it didn't even have its own high school. He had to go to nearby Reedley, which is where he and some special World War II veterans will be on Tuesday, November 4th at a fundraising dinner for Central Valley Honor Flight. This year marked the 80th anniversaries of VE Day and VJ Day, and Vern Schmidt and Norris Jernigan have special connections to both of those historic days. We'll get to hear about it that night and also hear from Chuck, who when we left off was talking about the missions he flew in Europe during the Cold War.
And I've just got to ask, because I've talked to a few people over the years who have carried that weight or that burden of having a nuclear mission, and you don't know if you're ever going to be called upon to execute that mission. Is that something that you wrestled with at all? Did it weigh on you any differently, the idea of carrying a nuclear weapon that could lead to the end of the world potentially?
Well, for the most part, we knew that if the whistle blew, we had no chance of ever coming back. I mean, that was a one-way mission. In those days, we were able to look at the war plans. I did so one day, and I found out that the area where my target was going to be decimated with nuclear aircraft delivering nuclear weapons, as well as international ICBMs. Literally, the world would end as we knew it. So the likelihood of that happening, you know, that would really have to be a catastrophic event of the magnitude that you just don't return from. I mean, it would be devastating. It was just a little bit out of the realm of realism. You know, who in God's green acres are going to do something that would self-destruct them, not only other nations, but their own nation. But nonetheless, you knew that if the whistle blew, you were going to go on a one-way mission.
And I just have to ask, were there occasions where you thought you were getting close to that kind of point, where maybe there was a false alarm or
I think that happened during the Cuban crisis.
Yeah.
Of course, we were still going through pilot training when that happened. There have been times when diplomacy was greatly needed, really and truly, the if you knew of the magnitude of destruction, nobody in their right mind would do it. You know, so that keeping that in mind, you know, the likelihood that you were going to go do that was so out of the realm of possibilities that you really didn't worry about it that way much. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, people would say, well, you know, he had his head in the sand. We carried nuclear weapons on a fighter that were 100 times, or 1,000 times, I think, larger than Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Yeah. a bomb on our aircraft in those days could have been 1.2, 3, 1.5 megatons. So that's a million tons of TNT. So the destructive 10 kilotons, 10,000 tons of TNT destroyed Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Well, can you imagine what a 1 megaton, 1 million tons? Now, the LA basin is what, 40 miles across or 50 miles across? It would devastate all of LA. Mm-hmm. So that's when I say how outlandish it was to think that somebody would be stupid enough to do that.
Well, let's hope they're still not stupid enough to do that, because the weapons are even more advanced now. And I'll just let you pick it up where you left off. I don't want to jump ahead of where you were in your progression.
Again, we had a multitude of missions that we had to deal with when we were there. And then toward the just about 2 years into my tour, they decided that they wanted to make all fighter pilots forward air control qualified. So during that time, we had to go over and work with the Army, just like we were going to do so if a war broke out or a conventional war broke out. And of course, this is a time in 1965 when we started sending people to Vietnam. So that was an inkling of what would happen at that time. And I know a lot of us were worried about having to go fly as a forward air controller. Not that it was that dangerous, although flying a small airplane is probably more dangerous than flying a jet through. But just being working with the Army, nobody wanted to do that. And if we wanted to go to war, we wanted to at least be in a fighter. And so fortunately, I didn't have to end up as a forward air controller, but not in a prop job. Anyways, not to digress, but you had a 3-year commitment in Europe. At that time, we had a 5-year commitment because of going with fighters. Normally, it was a 4-year, and if you opted for fighters, it was going to be 5 years. Well, for some odd reason, we ended up with 6. And about the time I got my assignment to Vietnam, they came back and said, well, we were wrong. You only have a 5-year commitment, but you've already got your orders.
Sucker!
Yeah.
So anyway, I was working with the Army, and the guy with me, my fellow pilot that was over there with me, said, Charlie, he said, I'm getting out of this thing. I said, I'm leaving the Air Force. I said, what are you going to do? He says, I'm going to go fly with the airlines. I said, you really want to fly a multi-engine? He said, those multi-engine pilots make $30,000 a year, and they have 10 days a month off. I said, come on, where do you get that? He said, I'm telling you, that's the truth. I said, that's ridiculous. He said, I know they do. I said, how do you know? He said, my brother works for the airlines. I said, you're kidding. So when I got back, we started discussing airlines, and a bunch of the guys said, yeah, we ought to do that. Man, that's a great life, plus good-looking girls. So I decided that I was going to get out. Several other guys did, but then this catch-22, you've got a 6-year commitment, so you can't get out. Well, we all decided to volunteer for Vietnam so that we could get out earlier and go to the airlines. Well, unfortunately, they said, no, you've got a commitment in Europe, and then you have to go. So we ended up opting for forecasting for Vietnam when the time came. Mm-hmm. And so we went from Europe to Vietnam.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but your specific mission in Vietnam was actually something I don't think you were allowed to talk about to anybody, right?
Originally, no, that's not true. Originally, I was assigned to a base in South Vietnam. And while I was there, about 6 months into my year, my commander asked me what I felt about going to fly a program called MISTI. It was actually called Commando Saber. MISTI was the call sign, and that was because the first commander of the Commando Sabres was Major Bud Day. And that was his favorite song, so he chose the call sign MISTI. And so I knew a few guys that had gone up and flown it, and they were really excited about it. I really never had a great desire to go up and fly in somebody's back seat, because up there, the mission was you were a forward air controller in the F-100. and they used the F-100 F model to do so. The F model was a two-seat used for training, and the Air Force had a number of them because we had a lot of F-100s to start with. And so in the South, we had forward air controllers that worked as liaison between the Air Force and the Army. Some of the forward air controllers would just go over the border into the North Vietnam and try to put in strikes. But the problem was they had no sustainability because they were slow and they could get shot out of the sky in no time at all. So a fellow that I had flown with in England had come up with the idea that we ought to use a fast mover and use them as forward air controllers over North Vietnam, over enemy territory. And the program was such that you would use two pilots in the F-100. The pilot in the front seat would direct the airstrikes. The guy in the back seat would have all the maps. He would have a recorder. He would have a camera to check a BDA at the end, bomb damage assessment. Mm-hmm. And he would have a recorder to record all of the conversation. And then he would take down all of the bomb armament that of the flights that we would conduct. The mission was to go in over North Vietnam, somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 feet. 4,000 feet was to kind of get you out of the small arms, and 6,000 feet was the maximum you wanted to fly so that the anti-aircraft wouldn't get you. So as a result, they initiated this program called Commando Saber because it worked well because the F-100 had great visibility and we had plenty of F-100 F models, so it was started. And my objection to flying over the North wasn't the fact that I was going over North Vietnam. It was having to fly the back seat periodically. And most fighter pilots don't like to do that.
Just because you're not in control? Or?
Basically, yes, yeah. You're right. And so anyway, the commander asked me if I'd like to go fly Misty, and I said, no, I really wouldn't like to. He said, well, we have to send somebody up. And I said, well, so-and-so would like to go fly it. I said, he could take my slot if you don't mind. He said, well, I didn't know that. He said, yeah, I'll let him go. Well, it turned out that he didn't have enough time in country, so there were some criteria that required somebody with my experience. And so he said, if you'll just go up for a couple of months, then I'll send Dave up to relieve you. I said, okay, so I'll do that. Well, when I went up to the program, I knew half the guys in there. I'd flown with them in Europe, and it was an exciting program. Probably the first 5-6 missions, and the missions were long. They were 4 to 6 hours in an F-100, and so normally a fighter is only going to last, especially under those conditions, for about an hour because you're constantly in full military power or afterburner. So we enter the pack, do some wrecking, and then go up and air-to-air refuel. On some mission, we'd refuel up to 5 times. And as I said before, because you're at full military. And when you entered the North Vietnam, you had to constantly move or jink. You were constantly moving the airplane in one direction or the other to avoid getting shot down. When I first started going up there, they had radar, and they'd come up on radar. And then later, within a couple of months, we develop a warning device for the radar. And so we would pick up radars, which we could home in on. And so when they realized that we could do that, they started going back to visual. And after about four or five missions, you got pretty adept at finding things, you know, because we're over the same area every day, 4 to 6 hours, and you would look at sites. You might see that there were some roads that led into an ammo dump or whatever, but the next day it was changed and it would go off in another direction. So you would really look closely at that so that, and you would find things, a windshield or a odd geometric form that would give you a clue that there's something there that shouldn't be there. So after about, as I said, about 4 or 5 missions, you got what we used to call misty eyes. You were able to pick up things on the ground that you would normally not notice or even see under normal circumstances. But we got really adept at finding things, finding irregular patterns or new roads that were created. And so our mission was to interdict and stop all of the arms and traffic that came into South Vietnam from North Vietnam, and we were pretty effective at it. Yeah, we would go up and we'd find a target, and we'd call the controlling agency and ask them to send us whatever fighters they could. They'd send us a fighter. We'd orbit with them, describe the target, tell them what anti-aircraft was in the area, and then we'd roll in and mark the target with the white phosphorus rockets. And then we'd tell them a direction to hit from our smoke. So we always were the first in on the target. Of course, we always got shot at pretty heavily. And then we'd go back over the target and get the bomb damage assessment to give to the flight. And then we'd sometimes take pictures of before and after, or mostly after, and then send them on our way, and then we'd bring in some more and continue that all day long. So we were exposed to a lot of ground fire, to say the least. On an average mission, we took about 2,000 rounds of small arms, 30 caliber, but about 200 rounds of anti-aircraft, 37, 57, 85 millimeter. So it was pretty exciting.
Yeah. I don't know if I would have described it that way.
Well, you know, we were young. We were aggressive. I tell people we were invincible until we weren't. About the time your engine quit or you got shot and you got hit, that's when your invincibility ceased. Then there was a panic mode of what am I going to do next? So it was exciting and it was rewarding. The most rewarding was when somebody else got shot down and we conduct the air, the rescue operation. And so that was really gratifying to be able to help somebody get out of a bad situation.
Sounds like something we need to explore when we come back, and we'll see if we can get Chuck to admit what medal he was awarded in the process. Don't forget to check out hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos, a brief video, and other information relating to Chuck Shaheen and his unique story. You'll also find the info for that November 4th event in Reedley, California. And here's one important piece of info if you'd like to purchase tickets. The phone number. Here's the number to call, 559-318-7165. If you want to reserve your seats before it sells out, again, that's area code 559-318-7165. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 85-year-old fighter pilot Chuck Shaheen. You can meet him November 4th in Reedley, California, and all that info is available for you online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. So you mentioned, the most fulfilling and rewarding was rescue operations.
What role did you guys play in leading to the rescue of your fellow Misties?
To give you an example, I was putting in, you just mentioned surface air missile. There was a surface air missile on the carrier, the bed. It hadn't been set up yet. And I had a flight of two F-105s. So I said, I'm going to roll in, mark the target, which I did. And I said, we've got some bad aircraft to the south. And I described it. And so I pulled off. The pilot was Master One. And Master One rolled in. So the one's in, two's in. And they destroyed it. So he said, what else do you have, Misty? I said, well, we've got a little truck park up north, a little further north up in the pack. I said, but it's heavily defended. And I said, if you want to go do it, you've got to make one pass only. He said, let's go get them. So I said, all right. So I went up. They followed me. I said, okay, I'm going to roll in. You'll see the anti-aircraft. And so I rolled in, and I described, you know, the target, and I told them that, you know, you could see the anti-aircraft. It's all around me, and it's about 20 meters to the south of the target. And he said, we got it, Misty. So he rolled in, and as number one said, one's in, then I heard two's in, and then as number one pulled off, I was watching him. He says, one's hit. So he bailed out. So immediately I set up a rescap, meaning I notified all the agencies we've got a pilot down. And I watched him as he parachuted down. He hit in a field, and I finally got him up on the radio, and I said, move to the tree line to your south or north, or I can't remember what it was. And I started making lower passes over it, the area, to make sure that nobody, you know, messed with him. And so I did so while I was still trying to get the rescue mission coordinated. Normally what would happen is we would notify the agencies, and they would send in not only the helicopters, but they would also send in SPADs, A1s, that were prop-driven, but carried a heavy load of bombs and missiles. But they also would fly closer to the helicopters at a slower rate, and so they would effect the rescue if it was possible. Unfortunately, the Jolly Greens got up there to offshore, but the SPADs weren't available, or I can't remember what happened, but they weren't where they needed to be at that time.
For those who don't know, the Jolly Greens are the rescue helicopters.
Right. I said, well, I'll lead you in. I'll drop my gear. I'll drop my flaps. I'll really be with you. Just come in and get him. No, we can't do that. When you have, especially when you have just put in somebody on a target and he gets shot down, you really feel a responsibility. But more so, you really empathize because you're just like that guy on the ground. I mean, that's you down there. And we did everything possible to get him rescued. I ended up with minimum fuel, and my radio was going out. And I tried not to strafe any of the villages or any of the people coming to rescue to capture him, because I figured if we did that, they'd end up killing him. So I just made low passes over to just keep them away from him, thinking that, you know, if I could just do so until we can effect the rescue. Well, when I got bingo fuel, or in other words, when I got minimum fuel to make it back to base, somebody else was already there, another Misty to take over from. So I made it back to Da Nang and refueled and made it back home. They worked that rescue for the rest of the day. We had, I think, two more Misties after me, or maybe three. And that night we all got in an argument about whether it was even possible to rescue him. I went to bed somewhat miffed at the fact that we didn't get him. And about 8 o'clock in the morning, I got awakened and said, the fellow that woke me up said, you want to go get him? I said, what? He said, you want to go get him? I said, you're kidding me. He said, no, they left him there. So they left him there, and they brought in, I think, something like 8 or 10 gun sights. When I say a gun sight, normally a gun sight was six guns, mm-hmm. whether it's 37, 57, or 85. In the it was kind of configured in a Star of David, and then the radar would be in the center. So they brought in and left him as bait. Finally, by the time I got up there, they had killed most of the gun sights. They silenced them. We had one or two more left, maybe 12 guns left, and we were able to silence them. We finally got the Jolly Greens and the SPADs to come in and pick him up, and we did it. Wow. Which was really phenomenal, and that was really probably one of the greatest days of my life. Mm-hmm. to have been a part of that. I got to meet him. Oh, he came to our base to thank us. Mm. But I was gone at the time, and several years later, when I was working for the airlines, I got contacted by somebody at Nellis, and they were going to have a symposium on rescue, and they were going to cover Master 1, which was our rescue, and Bat 2-1, and all of the players that they could find that were part of that were invited as well. And so I got to meet Carl Light, who was Master 1, and that was really a trip. That was really something.
Was there anything that he shared with you about his perspective on that whole ordeal?
I pretty well knew what his perspective was. It was pretty tight. You know, when you're down there, you're really, that's probably as high anxiety as you can get. Because we knew it was not good to be a POW. There's no question about it, even though we hadn't heard back. But because of the history of Vietnam, the Vietnamese weren't treated very well by the French, as evidenced by the Hanoi Hilt. That was an infamous prison as it was. So they pretty much treated our people like they were treated at one time. I was able to return to Vietnam a couple of years ago. I was with one of the POWs, one of our POWs, and really got to know what it was like on a firsthand basis. And I've known other POWs that shared with us their experiences. Like I said, it was probably the best mission I ever had. It was really gratifying to be able to do that.
Were you guys decorated for that mission?
Yeah, several of us got decorations, yeah.
Which ones?
I think I was awarded the Silver Star for that, yeah.
I had to squeeze that out of you. It's one of the most prestigious medals anyone can earn, but it speaks to the courage that you all displayed. And you mentioned that about meeting POWs. I believe you mentioned a name earlier, Bud Day, the first commander of your unit. He became a POW, right?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was one of the first casualties. And he was awarded the Medal of Honor for his behavior as a POW. That in itself was indicative of the character of our people. I think what they had to go through was, and their behavior was above and beyond. It really is something to be respected, and they should have all been rewarded. And I'm sure they were, but you can never be rewarded enough for 6 years missing out of your life. You know, it's pretty, pretty grim, especially under those conditions.
And, you know, I just have to ask too, as you describe it, you talked about during that mission, you didn't know his name probably at that point, but Carl Light, I think you said his name was, you said that was you, right? In your mind, that could have been you. Did you ever have a time where you went through that situation in your mind, said, what would I do? How would I handle it if I became a prisoner?
Well, we had several missions at what I would describe as high anxiety. One night we were on a mission and went over an interdiction point, and there was two explosions, and my exhaust temperature went out of sight, and I thought we were hit. And so I immediately pulled up, and I yelled, "Mayday, mayday, we've been hit." The guy in the back seat said, "Hey, punch the doors off and hit the burner." I said, "No, I've got to wait," because I was afraid that the engine would explode because the exhaust temperature was way out of the limit. And I did punch the doors off, and I'm still talking to the controlling agency, telling them we're looking for a place to bail out. And then I decided I'd better go ahead and put it back in the burner. The EGT just pegged. So I brought it to MinAB, and the aircraft was shuddering, and we were barely climbing, but we did. We continued to climb. And to make a long story short, it's a long, involved process, but we finally made it into Thailand over a base at about 20,000 feet. My backseater said to me, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to try to land." Well, you're never supposed to land an F-100 in night. We were never supposed to land it unless it was daylight, perfect conditions, 10,000 feet of runway, a barrier, and all the, in other words, the ideal conditions, because it wasn't worth, you know. But at that point, we were told that there wasn't a safe place to bail out except west of the base. At 20,000 feet, I pull the power back. And we used to practice, you know, flame out landings. And I said, I'm going to try to land it. And he says, Jesus, we're too high. You know, you think you can do it? You think? I said, well, you got plenty of time. If you want to bail out at any time, we've got a lot of time. And if it looks bad, we'll bail out. So we normally practice that flame out pattern at 10,000 feet, but I was at 20. So I dropped the gear, flaps, speed brake, and started performing this, what we call SFO, simulated flame out, but it was an actual flame out in essence, because I didn't have any thrust except in afterburner. So we got on the downwind. He said, we're really high. We're really high. You want me to shut up? No, I said, keep talking. Now, my backseater was a guy named P.K. Robinson, and P.K. and I had flown in Europe together, and so I knew he was pretty capable, and I probably would have never done it if I had somebody else that I didn't have confidence in. Mm. But just his character and his flying ability gave me the confidence to do it. We got on the 270 point, and we're turning final. We're double where we should have been. We were higher, twice as high as we should have been. But I had elongated the whole circuit, and we ended up touching. Oh, I missed. There was no runway. The runway was closed. And this is, I guess I should have said that first.
That's kind of a big detail, yeah.
It is. Well, the runway was closed. When we got over the field, on our way to the airbase, we asked what the landing runway was. And he said, the runway's closed, but we've got a taxiway. I said, how long is your taxiway? He said, 5,000 feet. I said, do you have a barrier? And he said, no, but we have 2,000 foot of PSP. That was steel matting. So anyway, back to the story. We're on final, and I finally got it in position so that when we touched down, we were doing about 210 knots, just below the gear speed. And I touched down. I tried to use aerodynamic braking by keeping the nose up, but I couldn't see the taxiway because it was so narrow. But I did deploy the drag chute, and fortunately it caught. And we landed. We ended up landing and stopping about 500 feet on the PSP. Of course, we probably burned the brakes up. We never knew that because we left the airplane. We got out of the airplane, looked all over for the damage. There was no bullet holes, and we thought, gee, that's crazy. What the heck happened? Well, we looked up the tailpipe, and all of the turbine blades were gone, except for 5 or 10 of them. You know, there's three stages of turbine blades, and we had shucked most of them out. Whether we took a hit up the tailpipe or whatever, we never knew, because we went in and got pretty chafossed. We got pretty drunk, and as soon as we got up the next morning, of course, they flew us back to our base. So we never knew what happened to the airplane, but at least it was in one piece.
Well, it sounds like you had plenty of margin for error if you only went 500 feet on it. But I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, because you've never done this before. You don't know if it's going to work. You don't know if you're going to live or die. What are those moments when you're on final approach and you don't know how this is going to go? What goes through your head?
The adrenaline is running pretty good. You're just committed. I mean, you've got to do it or you're not going to do it. And we just thought doing it would be a lot better than punching out at night, not knowing where you're going to land. And at the time, we thought it was the right thing to do. Of course, years later, we still, to this day, we think, how in the hell did we do that? You know, that was really probably stupid. But at the time, we thought it was the right thing to do.
And if it hadn't have been the right thing to do, we wouldn't be having this conversation, which has really flown by, hasn't it? We're out of time for this episode of Hometown Heroes, but you really have to hear the story of Chuck's last Misty mission in Vietnam. So we're going to continue this chat on our next episode of Hometown Heroes. I hope you can join Chuck and World War II veterans Vern Schmidt and Norris Jernigan at that November 4th event in Reedley, California. I'll be there too. And I hope you'll join us again next time here on the radio when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.